Conceived in Liberty, Volume 4, The Revolutionary War, 1775 through 1784, by Murray N. Rothbard. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. Tom Paine. Volume 4, Preface. What? Another American history book? The reader may be pardoned for wondering about the point of another addition to the seemingly inexhaustible flow of books and text on American history. One problem, as pointed out in the bibliographical essay at the end of Volume 1, is that the survey studies of American history have squeezed out the actual stuff of history, the narrative facts of the important events of the past. With the true data of history squeezed out, what we have left are compressed summaries and the historian's interpretations and judgments of the data. There is nothing wrong with the historians having such judgments. Indeed, without them, history would be a meaningless and giant almanac listing dates and events with no causal links. But without the narrative facts, the reader is deprived of the data from which he can himself judge the historian's interpretations and evolve interpretations of his own. A major point of this and the other volumes is to put the historical narrative back into American history. Facts, of course, must be selected and ordered in accordance with judgments of importance, and such judgments are necessarily tied into the historian's basic world outlook. My own basic perspective on the history of man and, a fortiori, on the history of the United States is to place central importance on the great conflict which is eternally waged between liberty and power. A conflict, by the way, which was seen with crystal clarity by the American revolutionaries of the 18th century. I see the liberty of the individual not only as a great moral good in itself, or, with Lord Acton, as the highest political good, but also as the necessary condition for the flowering of all the other goods that mankind cherishes, moral virtue, civilization, the arts and sciences, economic prosperity. Out of liberty, then, stem the glories of civilized life. But liberty has always been threatened by the encroachments of power, power which seeks to suppress, control, cripple, tax, and exploit the fruits of liberty in production. Power, then, the enemy of liberty, is consequently the enemy of all the other goods and fruits of civilization that mankind holds dear. And power is almost always centered in and focused on that central repository of power and violence, the state. With Albert J. Nock, the 20th century American political philosopher, I see history as centrally a race and conflict between social power, the productive consequence of voluntary interactions among men, and state power. In those eras of history when liberty, social power, has managed to race ahead of state power and control, the country and even mankind have flourished. In those eras when state power has managed to catch up with or surpass social power, mankind suffers and declines. For decades, American historians have quarreled about conflict or consensus as the guiding leitmotif of the American past. Clearly, I belong in the conflict rather than the consensus camp, with the proviso that I see the central conflict as not between classes, social or economic, or between ideologies, but between power and liberty, state and society. The social or ideological conflicts have been ancillary to the central one, which concerns who will control the state and what power will the state exercise over the citizenry. To take a common example from American history, there are, in my view, no inherent conflicts between merchants and farmers in the free market. On the contrary, in the market, the sphere of liberty, the interest of merchants and farmers are harmonious, with each buying and selling the products of the other. Conflicts arise only through the attempts of various groups of merchants or farmers to seize control over the machinery of government and to use it to privilege themselves at the expense of the others. It is only through and by state action that class conflicts can ever arise. This volume deals with the exciting events of the American Revolution, perhaps the most fateful years in American history. While the military history of the war necessarily takes first rank, it is not simply a recital of the battles. Intertwined with the tactics and the strategy of the war were ideological conflicts over how the war should be fought and what sort of government and society should emerge after the war was over. In particular, important light is shed on both the battles and the military strategy of the war by incorporating the latest historical researches, applying what we now know about the importance of guerrilla, vis-a-vis conventional interstate warfare, for the waging of a revolutionary armed struggle. The military histories of the Revolution, written before the 1960s, are hopelessly inadequate because they fail to grasp this vital dimension in explaining the course of the fighting. In addition to the history of the warfare itself, this volume discusses the political history of the period, in particular, the conflicts over the kinds of state governments to be constructed, and the drive of the nationalist for a strong central government. This period culminates in the adoption of the Articles of Confederation and in the rise to power of Robert Morris. Also discussed are the oft-neglected financial history of the war, the ruinous inflation and price controls, and the political financial manipulations of Morris and his associates. The book also deals with the Western lands question, which will take on fateful importance in the 19th century. It concludes by assessing the impact of the Revolution on America and Europe, and by asking the question, was the Revolution truly radical? My intellectual debts for this volume are simply too numerous to mention, especially since an historian must bring to bear not only his own discipline, but also his knowledge of economics, of political philosophy, and of mankind in general. Here I would just like to mention, for his methodology of history, Ludwig von Mises, especially his much-neglected volume, Theory and History, and Lord Acton for his emphasis on the grievously overlooked moral dimension. For his political philosophy and general outlook on American history, Albert J. Nock, particularly his Our Enemy, the State. As for my personal debts, I am happy to be more specific. This series of volumes would never have been attempted, much less seen the light of day, without the inspiration, encouragement, and support provided by Kenneth S. Templeton, Jr., now of the Liberty Fund, Indianapolis, Indiana. I hope that he won't be overly disappointed with these volumes. I am grateful to the Foundation for Foreign Affairs, Chicago, for enabling me to work full-time on the volumes, and to David S. Collier of the Foundation for his help and efficient administration. Others who have helped with ideas and aid in various stages of the manuscript are Charles G. Koch and George Pearson of Wichita, Kansas, and Robert D. Kephart of Kephart Communications, Incorporated, Alexandria, Virginia. To my first mentor in the field of American history, Joseph Dorfman, now professor emeritus at Columbia University, I owe in particular the rigorous training that is typical of that keen and thorough scholar. But my greatest debt is to Leonard P. Leggio, editor of The Literature of Liberty, San Francisco, whose truly phenomenal breadth of knowledge and insight into numerous fields and areas of history are an inspiration to all who know him. Over the years in which this manuscript took shape, I was fortunate in having several congenial typists, in particular Willette Murphy Klausner of Los Angeles, and the now distinguished intellectual historian and social philosopher Dr. Ronald Hamaway of the University of Alberta. I would particularly like to thank Louise Williams and Joanne Ebeline of New York City for their often heroic services in typing this manuscript. The responsibility for the final product is, of course, wholly my own. Murray N. Rothbard, November 1978. Chapter 1. Spreading the News of Lexington and Concord. The news of the victorious battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, hit the world like a thunderclap. They were truly a shot heard round the world, and it was the first order of the day for the Massachusetts radicals to make sure that the news spread, especially to the other colonies, in the right way. They needed to present a picture of events that would evoke sympathy and solidarity for the revolutionary cause. The basic outlines of the case were there in reality. Proud British troops had invaded the countryside outside Boston. They had launched an armed conflict by shooting down a brave, heavily outnumbered troop at Lexington. And finally, they were smashed by a triumphant array of enthusiastic, individualistic American farmers on the retreat from Concord. As historian Arthur Tortolo has put it, the British had marched out of Boston in force. The British had fired to kill first. The British had destroyed property. There had been bloodshed and death. All this established beyond any doubt that the Americans had been the victims. At the same time, and this was equally important, the Americans were also the victors. The half-believed argument that the American colonists would never stand up to British regulars was thoroughly shattered. But the facts had to be dressed up for popular consumption, especially before the British could turn on their engines of propaganda. There was little need at first to whip up Massachusetts, whose armed farmers were on fire and beginning to pour in to aid the militia. But it was essential, and much more difficult, to try to command the support of the other colonies for the revolution, colonies whose leadership had always been suspicious of the radicalism and individualism of the Bay Colony. While John Hancock, John Adams, and Sam Adams departed for the crucial meeting of the Second Continental Congress, scheduled for May 10, the leadership of radicalism in Massachusetts was left in the capable hands of Dr. Joseph Warren, a brilliant young man educated in liberty under Edward Guts Holyoake at Harvard. Warren had been the only political leader to participate in the first line of fighting over the whole course of the flight from Concord. Now the toast of Massachusetts, Warren set up civil headquarters at Cambridge on the day after the Concord battle, and was made acting chairman of the Massachusetts Committee of Safety. Less than 24 hours after the end of the Battle of Concord, he issued the first circular on the events of April 19. In the name of the Committee of Safety, Warren directed the circular to the prime immediate task, to raise an army of the Massachusetts militia. His circular, therefore, went to the Massachusetts towns and beat a drum fire of flaming warning against the British. The barbarous murders committed upon our innocent brethren have made it absolutely necessary that we immediately raise an army to defend our wives and children from the butchering hands of an inhuman soldiery, who, enraged at being repulsed from the field of slaughter, will, without the least doubt, take the first opportunity in their power to ravage this devoted country with fire and sword. Our all is at stake. Death and devastation are the certain consequences of delay. An hour lost may deluge your country in blood and entail perpetual slavery upon the few who may survive the carnage. He concluded by urging the speediest possible enlistment in a Massachusetts army. The British troops had scurried from the Charlestown Peninsula back to the safety of Boston across the river. And so the first task of the rebels was to raise an army to lay siege to Boston and contain the British forces within that city. That army sprang up literally overnight as, during April 20, militia from all over the province poured into Cambridge, where Artemus Ward and others, appointed as generals by the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, now made their headquarters. Militia also poured in rapidly from Connecticut and New Hampshire, and in a few days many thousands arrived from these two colonies. As a result, in an incredibly brief time, 20,000 eager militiamen formed an army laying siege to Boston. The provincial army, which the radicals had sought and which the provincial Congress had failed to raise only a week before Concord, was now in being. Although it had a leader, Artemus Ward, it was as yet a force of individualists, each coming and leaving on his own responsibility. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress met quickly on April 22. Now that an army, albeit an individualistic army, could at least temporarily hem in the British force at Boston, Joseph Warren, the new president of the Congress, turned to the vital barrage of education and propaganda directed to the other American colonies. Warren and the radicals realized the vital importance of public support and enthusiasm, and hence of agitation and propaganda, in this new type of war. Here was not a usual war begun by one government against another. Here was a people's war of revolution, waged against the existing state apparatus, begun without benefit of governmental or even organized direction. To continue demanded public support throughout the colonies for the Massachusetts cause. Virtually the first act of the Massachusetts Congress, therefore, was to appoint two committees, one to investigate the facts of Lexington and Concord, the other to draw up a narrative of what had happened there. Interestingly enough, while the Committee of Inquiry was making a careful investigation of the facts, the Narrative Committee was already writing its rather distorted report, and with little reference to the inquiry. Its chairman was none other than Dr. Benjamin Church, later discovered to be a secret traitor and informer, who felt he had to go out of the way to proclaim his devotion to the revolutionary cause. Church's report, issued on April 26, reveled in fake atrocity stories, always an effective device for whipping up hatred of the enemy. Dr. Warren, when editing the report, added further touches to the manufactured atrocities in an appeal to the people of Boston. Special teams of couriers swiftly carried the Church report throughout the colonies, and the newspaper press hastened to publish the story, liberally adding further atrocity tales of their own. Many papers, refusing to wait for their weekly publication date, issued handbills as extra editions as soon as the news arrived. Often the printed account was edged in heavy black borders and the headlines such as "Bloody News" and "Bloody Butchery by the British Troops" abounded. Isaiah Thomas, editor of the fiery radical Massachusetts Spy, had moved his press from Boston to Worcester. From there he fired off a blast that was reprinted in newspapers throughout the colonies. Thomas called on Americans to forever bear in mind the Battle of Lexington, where British troops, unmolested and unprovoked, wantonly fired upon and killed a number of our countrymen. No piteous cries, thundered Thomas, could divert the British troops from their design of murder and robbery. And the radical New York Journal mocked bitterly that the kind intentions of our good mother, our tender, indulgent mother, are at last revealed to all the world. For this mother was a vile impostor, an old abandoned prostitute, crimsoned o'er with every abominable crime, shocking to humanity. The Tory press, in the face of the intensity of popular feeling, was extremely circumspect about the events at Lexington and Concord. In Boston, it ceased publication altogether, and the papers in New York refused to carry the British side of the case.